I'd like to invite you to study with us this morning. We're going to be looking at the book of Revelation, chapter 2, if you'd like to turn there, page 824 in the Pew Bible, Revelation, the second chapter. I'd like to remind the 5th through 7th graders, we will be having our class tonight after services. Thank you for the prayers, the other words of encouragement offered during my trip to South Africa. I'm going to be giving a more detailed report of that trip next Sunday evening. But it's always a significant time for me to be with Christians in other cultures and other lands and to study with them, worship with them, interact with them. It just is so eye-opening in so many different ways, so encouraging to me, and a time for reassessment of things, to examine your life, your faith, your work, where you happen to be in the world over and against where other brethren are, and to see what conditions they are exercising their faith in. So thank you for the opportunity to go. And though I'll say more about that in detail next Sunday evening, the trip really, I suppose, in some way lies as a backdrop of the thoughts of the lesson this morning. Before John shares with all of the seven churches of Asia the apocalyptic vision that has been given to him by the Lord, he addresses each of these congregations, the Lord does through John, addresses them individually and speaks to them one-on-one and offers them words of encouragement, words of rebuke and warning, indicating his intimate knowledge of what is going on in each of these congregations, a thought that certainly ought to sober all of us. The lesson this morning, I'd like for us to compare, or contrast as the case may be, two of these epistles. The first being the short epistle to the church at Smyrna, and over and against that, the message to the church at Laodicea in Revelation chapter 3. But in chapter 2, beginning in verse 8, "To the angel of the church in Smyrna write, These things says the first and the last who was dead and came to life. I know your works, tribulation and poverty, but you are rich. And I know the blasphemy of those who say they are Jews and are not, but are a synagogue of Satan. Do not fear any of those things which you are about to suffer. Indeed, the devil is about to throw some of you into prison that you may be tested. And you will have tribulation 10 days. Be faithful until death, and I will give you the crown of life." Some features of this short message to the church of Smyrna. Number one, it is the shortest of all of the messages that the Lord has specifically to each of these congregations. And along with the message to the church at Philadelphia, there is no condemnation in this short epistle. There is no flaw or fault that the Lord feels compelled at this time to acknowledge. In fact, basically the message to them is stay as you are. Keep on doing what you're doing in spite of what is about to come. Jesus speaks to them of what appears to be on the outside. He says in verse 9, "I know your works, your tribulation, your poverty." And he also says, "I know the blasphemy of those who say they are Jews and are not." On the outside, they appear to be Jewish, perhaps by heritage and doctrine. But in reality, he says, they are a synagogue of Satan. This sounds an awful lot like what Jesus said to the Jews in John chapter 8. "You pride yourselves on being the descendants of Abraham, and you call God your father, but really you are of your father, the devil." And apparently the church in Smyrna is presently being persecuted by a Jewish element there. And Jesus says, I know what they're doing. And I really know who they are. They may be persecuting you under the banner of upholding the integrity of God and the law of Moses, but Jesus says, I know who they really are. And they're a synagogue of Satan. So from the outside, the circumstances of the church in Smyrna don't appear to be very attractive. He speaks of their tribulation and their poverty in the present tense, but what is John about to tell them? This vision that he's about to unfold suggests a lot of trouble to come. And so Jesus says, I know what you're already enduring, and I know there's more to come. The appearance of things is that you're not in a very good situation. The reality, in verse 9, but you are rich. Outwardly, they are full of trouble and difficulty. Inwardly, he says, you are rich. And I think they're rich as heaven would measure them. Brethren that have difficulty often are the ones who truly understand their faith. They're having to examine daily and against opposition what it is they really believe and how strongly they really believe it. Sometimes it's brethren undergoing tribulation who understand this earthly life in balance. And I can't help but think about the email Gardner has just sent out when he was talking about the issues he was undergoing the last few days with his heart and had time to sit in the hospital bed and think about what may lie in the future for him relative to his health. And he spoke in the email about thinking of the things that he was seeing on the television in the hospital room and how news of world events and who's playing who in football this week and so on and so forth. He said, you know, that just paled in importance to me. And his exhortation was well taken. How do we transfer that clarity of thought and seeing things in balance? How do we transfer that from the hospital bed to our daily lives? When the trial, when the tribulation is not consciously upon us. Those who are having difficulty often see earthly life in perspective more clearly, because that's what tribulation does to you, or for you maybe. Those having difficulty, like the brethren in Smyrna, often have a sharper sense of their dependence on God. Because of difficulty, they perhaps come to realize there's not a lot that I bring to the table here. There's not a lot for me to depend on that's in and of itself characteristic of my knowledge or abilities or my income, my ability to control health issues or whatever they may be. This, I think, is why Jesus looks at these folks in Smyrna and says, you know, you're really rich. Measured by appearance or measured by external things, it may be that you don't feel very rich. You see tribulation and you see poverty in verse 9. And you look at your work that you do for the Lord and perhaps don't see it returned in a way that you would like. But Jesus says, look, don't judge things by appearance. Judge things by the reality. And the reality as Jesus sees them is you are rich in spite of what you're going through. Something else that Jesus says here, I think, that brings these suffering brethren great comfort. And in fact, he says this in all of the epistles. Two simple words, I know. Now, sometimes he says that of their faults. I know. I know your faults. I know your flaws. I see what's really going on. But to the church at Smyrna, when he says, I know, what he's saying is, I see you as you really are, and you're in my favor. I know what you're suffering. I know the difficulties. I know what the Jews are doing to you. But I also know that you're truly rich. He says suffering is going to worsen for them, in fact. He says in verse 10, the devil is about to throw some of you into prison that you may be tested. It's going to get worse before it gets better. And the influence of Satan is going to be felt among you more strongly. This idea of being tested 10 days, I think, is one of the challenges in understanding the language of the book of Revelation, to realize that numbers and other such picturesque concepts are conveying an idea rather than something that is very specific and very definite. The idea of being tested 10 days may carry with it the idea that you're going to undergo a severe trial, but it's going to be for a limited period of time. It's not going to go on forever. It's going to have a limit. Jesus looks down the road and says 10 days. It's a measurable period of time that's going to come to an end. Nonetheless, it's going to be significant. And he says, the tribulation is going to be severe for you. But I know. I know who you are. I know what you're doing. I know what the opposition is. I know what it's going to be. And I know that you are rich. Let me ask you this question, giving what little bit of information we have here about the church in Smyrna. Does it sound like a congregation you'd want to be a member of? Can you maybe picture yourself in moving to Smyrna and searching around for brethren and finding this particular church? And perhaps having access to what Jesus has written to the church, would you consider casting your lot, placing your membership with a church that is described in this way? A church with trouble and difficulty that's only going to get worse. But Jesus gives them an exhortation. He says, be faithful until death. Perhaps that word should be unto. Be faithful even if it costs you your life, even if death is at the end of the way. Be faithful until death, and I will give you the crown of life. It is difficult for us in our culture and in our society to equate our faith with severe persecution. In this case, even to the point, perhaps, of dying. Be faithful unto or until death. We can understand, perhaps, through David's trips and his reports and through other access to information we have about brethren in China, that there is a very real possibility of these brethren being persecuted for their faith. But we sort of have to go around the other side of the world to contemplate that kind of a price being paid, perhaps, for our faith. The brethren in South Africa have something a little bit different to face. That is, not specifically persecution from the government itself. But the brethren who live there have other crosses to bear that are an outgrowth of the life that they're trying to live in their own environment. There were stories that abounded in all the places where I visited in South Africa about crime and how rampant it is. And brethren are having to live behind barricades. And robbery and breaking into homes is a fairly common thing. Basil Cass's son has had his house broken into 5 times in the last few months. And Brother Cass himself has had his automobile stolen just a few months ago. But it's worse than that. Other stories were told of going into certain neighborhoods and having the police tell Brother Cass when he enters the neighborhood, if something happens to you and you go in that neighborhood, we're not coming for you. You're on your own. And so here you have brethren living in an environment of crime and violence against property and potentially against persons. Brother Cass told of some close calls he's had just sitting in traffic with people coming and trying to open his car door. And carjacking is a fairly common thing there. And you know, as I was considering the brethren there and what they were having to live with, now, I wondered, would I move here? Would I just want to be a Christian here in this environment? What if this were my life and the future doesn't appear for South Africa to be much more encouraging? In fact, things are tending to go the other way. What about living in a place where there are heavy crosses to bear in trying to do what's right and stand up for the Lord and fight against the various false teachings that those brethren particularly have to deal with. Would you be able to see yourself in that kind of an environment? And if you were in that environment, would you see yourself as being rich and blessed? Or perhaps would you see yourself in living under a curse of some sort? Jesus says, "Be faithful until death, and I will give you the crown of life." You see, it's by those kinds of stresses and difficulties, again, that we measure our faith perhaps in a different way. We look a little more deeply into what we believe and why we believe it, and why am I here? And do I want to stay here? Do I consider it a blessing of God to be under these extreme circumstances? And yet Jesus says in the beginning of verse 10, "Do not fear any of those things which you are about to suffer." Do not fear. Whether in China or South Africa, or whether it's you living here in the United States and being a part of this congregation and all the blessings that may be attending your life, it may be that you have something that's on your horizon that you tend to fear. Jesus says, "I know." He says, "You're really rich. Do not fear. Be faithful to me and I'll give you a crown of life." This is a rich congregation. It doesn't appear to be so, perhaps, on the outside. But Jesus so says that it is. Now, in chapter 3, beginning in verse 14, we have another church being addressed specifically by the Lord relative to its circumstances and peculiarities. And this is a church that's sort of the mirror image of Smyrna. This church appears from the outside to be wealthy materially, very well off. It does not appear to be a church under duress. There's really nothing the Lord says to the church in Laodicea about difficulty, either internal problems or external threats to them. Bob Harkrider made this observation in his commentary on Revelation. He said that when an earthquake struck Laodicea in 60 AD, the city was so wealthy they turned down government subsidies from Rome to help them rebuild the city. Their coffers were full and they had enough to rebuild themselves. Now compare that to a New Orleans. Apparently there's not enough resource in New Orleans to rebuild itself. And so appeals are made to the federal government for help. Laodicea didn't have to do that. They were wealthy. In verse 18 of chapter 3, when Jesus gives this advice, "I counsel you to buy from me gold refined in the fire, that you may be rich, and white garments, that you may be clothed, that the shame of your nakedness may not be revealed, and anoint your eyes with eye salve, that you may see." The suggestion is, these things are being said sort of ironically by the Lord as He's addressing the sources of their wealth. Apparently gold was abundant, materially gold was abundant. But the Lord is saying you need another kind of gold. You don't need the gold that you can put in your pocket and go to the market and spend, or gold that you can invest. But He says, "Buy from me gold refined in the fire." Does that maybe point your mind back to Smyrna? Buy from me faith that is refined in the fire. Genuine fellowship and an understanding of things. That's what you really need to be thinking about. Not the gold that you can put in your pocket and go spend. Laodicea apparently was a center of banking by the secular references that we can read about regarding its history. So gold would have been much on the minds of the people. And then he says in verse 18 that they need to buy from him white garments that they may be clothed. Apparently there was a kind of black wool grown in the environs of Laodicea. Sheep that were raised that produced this luxurious black wool, and wonderful and beautiful garments could be made from the wool of those sheep. Jesus says it's not clothes, that outward adornment you need to be concerned about, but rather buy from me not black garments, but white ones. You need to be thinking about purity. You need to think about the cleansing that I can bring, turning that which is black, as it were, in sin, to something that is white as snow. You need to think about putting me on in holiness and purity rather than putting on the luxurious black garments. Then he says they need to anoint their eyes with eye salve that they may see. Again, apparently there's some medicinal salve that was produced in this area, Phrygian powder, that when applied would help perhaps clear up eye infections or whatnot. I really don't know exactly what it was used for, but apparently it was something Laodicea was known for. And so the Lord is playing off of these material things and saying, you know, it's not the ointment for your eyes you really need to be concerned about. It's opening the eyes of your heart, having true understanding and true insight into things. Those are the things that you need, because apparently, as we see in what Jesus says to them, the wealth and the self-sufficiency of the area itself has sort of crept into the consciousness of the people here. And in verse 17, because you say, I am rich and have become wealthy and have need of nothing. There's nothing said here, as we've already said, there's nothing said to them of immorality, like perhaps what we see being said to those in Thyatira. There's nothing that is said here about adopting false doctrines like the Nicolaitans, which is said to the church at Pergamos. There doesn't appear outwardly to be anything majorly wrong with the church at Laodicea. And their self-perception is everything's fine. We're doing okay. All things are in place. And we have need of nothing. The perception was they were very secure and very strong. The reality, the end of verse 17, Jesus said, and do not know that you are wretched, miserable, poor, blind, and naked. That's a pretty thorough description, isn't it, of spiritual destitution? In fact, what he says to them is, you're neither hot nor cold. You're not apostates. You've not turned away from me to some false doctrine. You're not living in gross immorality, but you just sort of don't stand for anything. You've lost your fervor. You've lost your zeal. You've lost your focus. They've become satisfied in themselves. And they do not realize anymore their sense of dependence on God. In that sense, the total opposite of the church at Smyrna. And here's the danger, I think, that we have to deal with here at Embry Hills, that we have to deal with as Americans living in a society in which we live, a society of abundance and wealth and comfort. You know, those conditions can so easily creep into our thinking about things that we don't even realize. Perhaps the level of spiritual erosion that's taking place. We have elders. We have good Bible teachers. We've got good Bible classes. We've got a lot of deacons. We've got good, strong, faithful people. We've got so much resource just in this congregation. And we live in a society where, yes, not everything is as well as we would like for it to be, but we manage. We get along. We cope with things. The occasional issue may arise, but somehow, for the most part, we seem to negotiate those. And life is good, and life is rich. It's so deceptive. So very easy for us to confuse those outward appearances with inward spiritual strength. And one thing I do not want to do, I think there's a tendency to do this. There's a tendency to make us feel guilty about the wonderful blessings that we have. And that's not the point of what I'm saying. We are rich and blessed, and we ought to revel and rejoice in it. This congregation has so many good things, and invariably when you go to foreign countries and the works are smaller and they struggle in many ways, invariably they will begin to ask you, well, what's it like at Embry Hills? It's a little embarrassing almost to say, well, you know, we have over 300 people. And their eyes just open a little bit wider. And we have a variety of classes to choose from. Usually 4 adult classes ongoing. And we have 21 deacons. And as you talk, their eyes get wider. You don't even want to embellish or go any further. And one of the sisters just kind of got this blissful look on her face, and she said, just one time I would like to hear that many people sing. I wonder if you felt that way this morning when we were singing. Isn't it easy to take for granted the wonderful blessings, the richness? I don't mean for us to feel guilty about it. What I mean for us in thinking about these things is to consider what Jesus is saying to the Laodiceans. You have a sense that you're in need of nothing. Everything is comfortable. No false doctrine threatening. No immorality in the church. Don't confuse the external signs of strength with internal faith. And I think that's one of the dangers that we face. And I'm reminded of that every time I go to a place like South Africa or Venezuela last year, or Russia, any number of places I've been. You see brethren struggling without many of the conveniences that we have, the richness, the wealth that we have in each other. And it's a constant reminder, and that's why I'm blessed to be able to make such trips. It makes me dwell on my faith and my understanding of who and what I am and why I am what I am. Why I am where I am, what I am doing on a day-in, day-out basis. We have to struggle more, I think, to find the true level of our faith than brethren who are undergoing trials and tribulations. And they have to be careful that they don't become like those in Smyrna and think of themselves as being poor when Jesus is saying, actually, you're the rich ones. You're the rich ones. Jesus says to those who have become lukewarm, I will spew you out of my mouth. I find your apathy, your indifference, your self-dependence, I find it revolting. You no longer see what it's truly about. What it's truly about is your dependence on me. Brethren, we can't ever afford to lose that. No matter how things stand where we are here at Embry Hills, or whether we end up moving at some point later on and we're a part of a smaller and more struggling work, wherever we happen to be, the strength does not lie in the numbers. It does not lie in the externals. The strength lies really in the Lord and the reality of our faith in Him. Jesus said, I'll spew you out of my mouth. As many as I love, I rebuke and chasten. And it may be that because of living in a place where we have so many advantages, there are times we might need to face hardship so that we are reminded. Again, as Gardner even has written, that we're reminded of what it's really about. And what I really concentrate on at the very depth of my being. And is it God? And is it Christ? And is it my faith in Jesus? And he says, be zealous and repent. The strength or the weakness of a local church is always going to come down to the members themselves. We've said this before, the strength of this congregation is not the eldership, though we rejoice in the elders we have, and we appreciate deeply the work that is done. We want to encourage them and hold them up and pray for them, and we want more like them. But the strength of a church is not the eldership. The relative strength or weakness of a church is going to rest on the individuals that comprise that church. And elders cannot drive with a whip. They can lead, they can encourage, they can exhort, but they're not it's not their job to drive. And they can't lead if brethren won't follow. Or they can lead, but nobody's going to be going with them. Jesus, in speaking to those in Laodicea, "As many as I love, I rebuke and chasten." That's an individual thing. "Behold," verse 20, "I stand at the door and knock. If anyone hears my voice and opens the door, I will come in to him and dine with him and he with me." Do you see how he's speaking now on an individual basis? The church at Laodicea needs to turn some things around, and it's going to be turned around by each person returning to the Lord in genuine faith. In, as it were, buying the gold from Him that's refined in the fire, and the white garments and the eye salve so they can truly see. Verse 21, "To him who overcomes, I will grant to sit with me on my throne, as I also overcame and sat down with my Father on his throne." Jesus leaves off speaking to the Laodiceans as a congregation and begins to appeal to the individuals. And as we close the lesson, that's the appeal that I would offer to you. It's on an individual basis. Our faith can be strong. Our faith can be vibrant in a situation like we're in here at Embry Hills, with strength on every hand, resources galore, wonderful blessings of being with so many brethren and enjoying the benefit of this kind of association. There can be, and I think there certainly is, great spiritual strength here. As we said, the danger is that as an individual, I may begin to confuse true faith in the Lord with the externals of being part of the group. And so the exhortation as we close is for each of us to look inside of ourselves and ask, what about my faith? What about my zeal? Am I fervent? Or would the Lord say to Jim Jonas, "I find you lukewarm. Jim, I find you just going along with the crowd. I find that you pride yourself on just being a member of the Embry Hills Church. But when I look at you standing alone, I see lukewarmness. And I love you, and I'm going to urge you to repent. But if you don't, I'll spew you out of my mouth." What would he say to me? Or would he say to me, "I see that you're really rich. I see that your faith is strong, and strong enough to endure." Look at it this way. What if the epistle that was sent to the church at Smyrna were sent to the church at Embry Hills? "I know what you're about to go through." Would he be able to say of us as a congregation, would he say of me and you as an individual, "But I know you'll come through it. I know I'll give you the crown of life after that period of difficulty and trial, because I know you're going to endure it and you're going to come through it with faith and trust intact." If the Lord addressed us as He's addressing the seven churches of Asia, what would He say to us as a congregation, and what application would there be to me as an individual? What is the degree of your faith in the Lord even this morning? Do you need to obey the gospel? Do you need to come to Him and commit yourself to Him, having really never done that? Might be you've had some religious inclinations and some warm feelings toward the Lord, but you just never actually said, "I'm committing my life to the Son of God." Do you need to do that today? We can help you. We can offer you the opportunity to do that. We'll help you obey the gospel of Jesus Christ. Having done that, perhaps, do you find that you have become lukewarm and not fervent, and perhaps have taken things for granted and need to take a stand and say, "That's going to change"? And if we can help you, encourage you, pray with you in making that kind of a change, we're certainly willing to do that. Can we help you while we stand and sing?